from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. The stock market has been on a wild ride this month, plunging, surging, unnerving. Investors seem hopeful about the U.S. economy, worried about others in Europe, Asia, South America. There's geopolitical tension from the Middle East to Russia to Hong Kong, worries about Ebola, worries about China. This hour On Point, a tour of the global economy that's got things feeling shaky. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you believe the U.S. is the bright spot right now? Here's Christine Lagarde, head of the IMF's annual meeting, saying the global economy is weaker than expected and will plateau without specific multilateral reform and investment. Listen for her phrase, the new mediocre.
There has to be a new momentum. A new momentum that will consist of putting a set of bolder policies together in order to overcome what I would call the new mediocre. And that's a risk if it stagnates as such, if we have this horizon of new mediocre.
The new mediocre, no thanks, doesn't sound so good. Joining me now from London is Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator at the Financial Times. His new book is The Shifts and the Shocks, What We've Learned and Have Still to Learn from the Financial Crisis. He's a big interpreter, as grand and important and an economic journalist can ever become, says the New York Times. Martin Wolf, that's very grand language, but I guess you deserve it. Thank you for joining us today, sir.
I'm not going to comment on that comment.
Yes, I'm sure you've taken plenty of comment on that already. And with us from Washington, Ishwar Prasad of Cornell University, professor of trade policy there, was chief to the Financial Studies Division in the IMF's Research Department, and before that, head of the IMF China Division, author of a new book getting a lot of attention lately, The Dollar Trap, How the U.S. Dollar Tightened Its Grip on Global Finance. Ishwar Prasad, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Hello, Tom. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
It's great to have you both. Martin Wolf, there's so much to look at here. Just to begin to dive in, you write that it's important not to exaggerate the story of slowdown in the world economy, but when Christine Lagarde talks about the new mediocre, you're very keyed into what she's talking about. What's the risk here? What's the new mediocre rooted in?
It's a nice phrase, and it's a good change from the new normal, probably a little more specific.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite an interesting picture. One has to break it up a bit. Clearly, the performance of the major developed countries that were hit by the crisis in 2007-08, and then within the Eurozone somewhat later, more severely, has never regained a pre-crisis dynamism. That's true of the U.S. The growth rate is well below the pre-crisis rate and looks sort of set there. That's an interesting question. And the Eurozone really hasn't regained growth at all. So it's essentially stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
So that looks pretty bleak. Japan is trying to get reasonable growth momentum, and that also looks difficult. So the developed countries do look quite mediocre, and in the case of Europe, worse. Now, the emerging countries are more interesting because the change is more recent.
Mm-hmm.
They went through the crisis, except for the crisis year itself, which affected some of them very badly, really remarkably well. And it was probably, well, not probably, it was the first time, actually, since the Second World War, when you had a huge crisis hitting the developed world. It was the most severe that it has experienced since the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, basically, emerging countries went through well. But more recently, we are beginning to see progressive declines in growth forecasts and growth performance for the very large part of the emerging world. And it's extraordinarily general. And particularly, and perhaps most significantly, because it's such a huge economy and has been so remarkably dynamic, we're now getting used to the idea that China is slowing quite substantially. And many people, including me, think that China could slow much more than many suppose. So we've got this new story in the emerging world, and that raises lots of very, very interesting and important questions about the economy. But the last point I would make is one shouldn't overdo this. What the IMF is forecasting for the emerging world is growth, if I remember correctly, at about 4 or 5%. And that still implies very, very rapid growth in much of the emerging world and continued outperformance of the developed world and continuous shifts of the world economy towards the emerging economies.
Yusra Prasad, we don't want to pin too much on even a month of volatile stock market movement, but it has been a very striking month. What's going on just now, in your view, that set things on such a roller coaster, in the last 4 or 5 weeks?
The key thing about stock markets, Tom, is that they're not so much reflective of current economic activity as what market participants think is going to happen in the future.
Of course, yeah.
And the difficulty right now is that it's very, very difficult to read the tea leaves. As Martin pointed out, there is slowing growth momentum in many of the major economies. Europe and Japan are not doing well at all. The emerging markets are still growing, but there is a sense of foreboding that the growth, even in economies like the major emerging markets and in the U.S., is somewhat fragile. I mean, here in the U.S., as you pointed out, we seem to be doing relatively well compared to the rest of the world, but this is not a recovery that seems to be benefiting a lot of people who are still unemployed or people who are looking for full-time work but only finding part-time work. So that sense of foreboding, I think, has created a lot of uncertainty. And then every piece of data that comes in leads to a reevaluation of what people think the major prospects are. So in the last couple of weeks, we've had some bad news from other parts of the world, from Europe, from Japan, and from China, which led people to think that perhaps global growth was going to slow, but the U.S. seemed to be doing just fine. And then a couple of pieces of data, including retail sales numbers, came in last week, which led the market, in my view, to somewhat overreact because there was a concern that perhaps the U.S. economy would no longer be able to carry the burden of world growth on its own shoulders. So I think what we are seeing in stock markets is basically the uncertainty and, to some degree, fear also caused by issues like the Ebola epidemic, which hasn't had much of an economic disruptive effect, but there is a sense that it could end up being something like the SARS epidemic a few years ago, which did have a fairly detrimental effect on world travel, on world trade, and so forth. So I think it's a combination, really, of uncertainty and fear that is roiling stock markets now.
Yusra, you'll understand it may feel ironic to many Americans that the U.S. economy is seen as somehow the anchor or perhaps the best performing in relative terms right now. Many Americans haven't felt a robust return to growth or a robust change in their personal circumstances. Is it that the U.S. is really doing well or the rest of the world is off its game?
The reality here is in international finance, everything ultimately is relative. So China is still growing faster than the U.S. This year, it's expected to grow at somewhere in the range of 7 to 7.5%. The best the U.S. can hope for is probably around 2.5%. But it's growth momentum that seems to matter here. And the U.S. certainly seems to be doing better in terms of that momentum. If you look at the labor market, the unemployment rate is down below 6%.
Right.
The economy has generated about 200,000 plus jobs per month over the last year. But set against that is the fact that median wages are not rising. The labor force participation rate, the number of people actually either employed or looking for work, that percentage has fallen by about 3 percentage points since its recent peak in 2007. So it doesn't feel like a recovery to the average American. And that's where this dichotomy comes in. The U.S. is pulling the rest of the world along because it's the one economy that has positive growth momentum. But many Americans certainly don't feel it.
Martin Wolf, in London, what has happened with Germany? Germany was the engine that was pulling Europe along, or so we thought. And now even Germany seems in trouble. What's happened there, Martin?
Can I just comment on one aspect of the U.S., because it's also true for Europe, which actually puts together what Yusra was saying, which is productivity growth has been remarkably poor, particularly after the first couple of years after the crisis. Mm-hmm. And that's been true almost everywhere in Europe. And that has a paradoxical effect. It makes the labor market performance rather good, better than you'd expect given the very weak growth. So
meaning more hires because less productivity per worker.
Yeah, so that means you have to have more workers, it were. Exactly the same has happened in the UK and in Germany. Since we mentioned it to some degree in France and Italy as well. The one exception has been Spain, where productivity has risen a lot, and so unemployment has soared. But the basic point is that's very worrying for the longer-term future of all the developed countries, because in the long run, it's productivity growth that drives living standards. Mm-hmm. If output per worker doesn't rise rapidly, then ultimately real wages won't. There are other factors, but that's the biggest single factor. So that what we in the UK now call the standard of living crisis is actually closely related to the fact that despite very weak growth, our labour market has improved so much. It's really quite a paradox. But to return to your question...
Let's hold Germany in a word. What's your explanation for the stagnant productivity growth?
I think in a word, I don't know. Or three words, mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. There are many hypotheses, and we perhaps should explore that further, because it is the biggest single question about the future of the developed world, in my view.
We are at a very interesting moment in the path of the global economy with two terrific interpreters of what's going on. With us from London, Martin Wolf, chief economics commentator at the Financial Times. His big new book is The Shift and the Shocks. From Washington, Ishwar Prasad is with us from Cornell. His book, The Dollar Trap, we'll look at that as well. Martin, Ishwar, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the global economy, what's working, what's not, what's wobbling, and the story behind those crazy markets lately. Europe in trouble, China with troubles, the U.S. is the anchor, believe it or not, for now, but issues here too. Martin Wolf joins us from London, chief economics commentator at the Financial Times, author of the big new book, The Shift and the Shocks. Ishwar Prasad is with us from Washington, out of Cornell, big book, The Dollar Trap. You can join us. Did your nest egg take a hit in the last month? Has it come back? What's your biggest global economic fear? A China crash, eurosclerosis, Russian rampage factors, Ebola? What's your question for Martin Wolf, Ishwar Prasad, on what's going on out there? Here's a little commentary from the Europe side. This month in Naples, we had protests blaming the European Central Bank for the lagging economy. ECB President Mario Draghi said he understands why people in Europe are frustrated.
You know, it's very understandable that people are Eurosceptical, because things are not going well in opposite directions. In this part of the world, things are not going well because you have pervasive unemployment and you have very low, weak economic activity with, and in some countries, with a recession that seems to never end.
And even in Germany, yes, here's Heiko Peters of Deutsche Bank talking last week with Deutsche Welle, the Berlin-based broadcaster, about why Germany's economy is struggling.
One part is that the higher geopolitical risk due to Ukraine-Russia crisis that is pushing down German exports, and also question marks on the recovery in Europe, where especially the situation in Italy and France, Italy is in recession, France economy is stagnating, is getting more worrisome.
Even Germany. Martin Wolf, let me come to you on Germany. You write, it's Germany that set the economic strategy of the Eurozone. What's gone wrong?
Well, first of all, you asked the question in the sort of tone which suggests that it's surprising that Germany's economy has stagnated. But this is based on a very common but almost complete mistake. Germany is not a locomotive. My line is that it's a caboose. Germany has developed. It's actually a very long story, but it reestablished it after the beginning of this millennium. An immensely export-oriented and also export-dependent economy. It has the largest current account surplus in the world. It's about 7% of GDP. It hasn't fallen during the crisis.
So it doesn't generate activity. It rides activity.
It doesn't generate enough demand internally. Mm-hmm. Domestic demand over the last 10 years has been growing in real terms at about 1% a year. Since the crisis, it's really hardly grown. I think it's up about 3% since the crisis. So it generates no demand. It depends on demand elsewhere in the world, mm-hmm. which it's the Eurozone, which is far and away its most important trading partner, is, as was pointed out, in recession.
Yes.
Real demand in the Eurozone as a whole is 5% smaller in the most recent quarter we have compared with the pre-crisis period, while the US has risen by 6%. So it's a massive difference. China is now weakening, and Chinese investment is weakening, and luxury spending is weakening. That all affects Germany's exports, all of it. And it is an incredibly open export-dependent economy. So it cannot grow if its partners don't grow around the world.
Yeah.
And the problem that I mentioned in the Eurozone, to narrow that down, is it's actually imposing policies on the rest of the Eurozone that require extreme austerity in all the other economies. So inevitably, it rebounds back on Germany negatively. The Germans are committed to their own fiscal austerity, so that tends to mean they become even more stringent. And the result is a spiral of stagnation. And one consequence of that, and it's the last comment on this, is that inflation in the Eurozone is, well, at the core, if you strip out the more exceptional items, around about 1%. Germany's is about 1%. And any economy that wants to gain competitiveness against Germany, because many of them lost it in the pre-crisis years, now is close to zero inflation or even deflation. And that raises their real debt levels. So the German role in this crisis is misunderstood and incredibly problematic. And as long as this continues, in my view, there is no hope for the Eurozone in escaping from the crisis.
Ishwar, if I may follow up on that, Germans have their predilections, but they're no fools if they're exporting, but they need other Eurozone countries to buy. Austerity would seem like a path to fewer purchases, and yet they're pushing austerity. How do you explain that, Ishwar?
It's a very difficult issue, as Martin pointed out. The German predilection towards fiscal austerity and towards their narrative about structural reforms, that is, reforms to get labor and product markets going, at some level has appeal, because unsustainable levels of debt and the fact that many European economies had become uncompetitive is a problem. But the difficulty is that Europe was constrained to do two very difficult things at the same time. Number one, deal with fiscal austerity and undertake these very difficult reforms. Reforms of this sort to improve competitiveness, not just labor markets and product markets, but also red tape, the crushing tax burden, and so forth. Dealing with those invariably involves some dislocation. Mm-hmm. And if at the same time you have that dislocation, you're trying to tighten your fiscal belt, that becomes very difficult politically and, as we are seeing, economically. So it's not that Europe had much of a choice because they had been pushed to a corner. But at this stage, I think there is a legitimate question about whether the sort of policies that Germany is suggesting other economies in the Eurozone should adopt are good either for the Eurozone or for itself. The difficulty, however, is that relying entirely on monetary policy, on Mr. Draghi, the head of the European Central Bank, whom you referenced a little while ago, that is a real risk as well, because the presumption there is that monetary policy would do the magic, but unless other policies are supporting monetary policy, and they're not doing that right now, it's not going to be very effective.
Martin Wolf, we heard Heiko Peters there of Deutsche Bank saying, citing first of all the geopolitical risk of the Ukraine-Russia crisis. How big a dent in the German economy has that produced? If it's a big debt, does it mean that Europe will back off the sanctions it's imposed on Russia to get that piston moving again?
It's clearly one of the factors. I haven't yet seen a compelling analysis which suggests it's decisive. But Germany does a lot of business with Russia. And so it's another negative factor in the range of negative factors we've discussed that's part of the weakening demand for Germany. Russia is a much less important trading partner than some of the others we've been discussed, however. The question of whether this will lead to a shift in policy is a very good and important one. There are many forces inside Germany, particularly business forces, which are very opposed to or very unhappy with the sanctions policy. Angela Merkel herself, I think, is committed to it. She feels, as I understand it, very strongly. Remember, she was an East German. She has a lot of experience with Russia. She feels very strongly about the behavior of Russia. And she feels that she's been lied to by Mr. Putin. That's a personal thing. And she's strong enough to continue with the sanctions if she wants. And I suspect that the likelihood is they will. But strengthening them further would certainly be quite difficult. And, of course, we don't really know where the Putin program is going to take him. There are many fears about what he might do beyond what he's doing. That's another very important factor. And, we haven't discussed in depth the many geopolitical uncertainties beyond the economic ones. And this is obviously important. But I would stress that the project, I would be less friendly than Ezra has been about the project. The project of managing the adjustment of the Eurozone to the crisis was mishandled pretty consistently, except by the European Central Bank under Mr. Draghi. And we have reached the limits of monetary policy unless it gets very unconventional, which Germany is also resisting. And I think we've got a strategic problem. It's not just about these little local difficulties like Ukraine and Russia. By this, I mean in the sense that they're not the core economic issues, that they're not very important. Mm-hmm. They are.
You've called it an extraordinary state of managed depression going on here. We've got China to look at, India, and much more. Callers for Martin Wolf and Ishwar Prasad as well. John in Springfield, Illinois. Thank you for calling, John. You're on the air.
Well, thanks for having me. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I was not at all surprised that the United States has rebounded as well as it has. I really think that the aggressive monetary policies that were instituted at the beginning of the recession really stopped the United States from falling deeper into depression and allowed it to recover much quicker. And I think what you're seeing in the European Central Bank is that they've been late to that party, possibly because they were so concerned about the measures of austerity that they had to impose upon some of the smaller member countries, that they didn't go as aggressive with perhaps interest rate cuts and other monetary measures that they could have taken, and they weren't unified in that early on. And I think just recently when they reduced rates further, I think that it was an acknowledgement that they hadn't been aggressive enough. And I think you're seeing that now. I know that some of our recovery hasn't spread to all members of society, and I think that's going to come. And I think that's going to continue to improve over the next several years. I don't believe we're going to fall into another recession. I believe we'll be in somewhat of a lower, smaller expansion for some time to come.
I appreciate your call, John, very much from Springfield. That issue of how it's been spread around, Martin Wolf writes about, Ishwar addresses as well. We'll look at that. Let me get one more. Brian in Hartford, Connecticut. Brian, you're on.
Hello. I just want to make a comment. Mr. Wolf kind of hit on the point before about the forced austerity in the Eurozone. I think that's really dragging their economy down. I'd also just like to make a comment that I think GDP is a very poor indicator of economic prosperity, if you will. Just as you could see, the middle class in the U.S. is really struggling right now, which I think is more caused by globalization and neoliberal policies. Just wondering if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Absolutely. Not enough to look at the big number. Look inside. Martin Wolf does. So does Ishwar. We'll look at that. And one more. We'll take it to them. Tom in Boston. You're on, Tom.
Yes. My concern is the American stock market, at least, is just being propped up primarily by the Federal Reserve, continued quantitative easing, and keeping the interest rates down. And that's what's propping it up rather than productivity. And my additional concern is the Federal Reserve has merely become a political operation of the Democratic Party by keeping the markets up through the elections to try to get a Democrat in there in 2016. And the market really, based on productivity and profits, wouldn't be that high, and the average worker is being penalized, yet the investor is being rewarded by the stock market being propped up, again, by the Federal Reserve becoming a political operator.
Tom, hot points all, and we'll look at those as well. We're looking at the global economy with Martin Wolf of the Financial Times, Ishwar Prasad out of Cornell. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let me go first from that buffet from our listeners, if I may, Ishwar, to you on the charge of a U.S. stock market being propped up by the Fed, not by productivity. At this point, do you see that? And where do you see Janet Yellen going?
You know, the U.S. is a fundamentally resilient and dynamic economy, and that's why we're seeing the U.S. doing relatively well. But the U.S. had two things going for it. One, it had Ben Bernanke, a student of the Depression, in charge of the Fed during a very difficult time. And the U.S. was willing to throw orthodoxy out the window when it came to dealing very aggressively with all the policy tools at hand in terms of trying to get its economy back on track. But this has costs, and the costs in particular are that we are facing a very uneven recovery, and there is a sense that there are lots of risks building up, especially in the financial market, because of what the Fed in some sense had to do. Now, here again, if there were other policies working in tandem with the Fed, so for instance, if we had fiscal policy supporting the recovery, it would have been easier. But what we are doing with fiscal policy, and certainly the deficit has come down, the problem is that we haven't dealt with the longer-term entitlement problems on fiscal policy, which deal with the contingents, with the sustainability of U.S. fiscal policy. And instead, we've cut a lot of public expenditures to the bone, which are going to have implications for long-term productivity, which Martin had referred to. We are cutting expenditures on education, on social services, on health, and this is going to affect the long-term productivity of the U.S. economy. So even though we do have a recovery at hand based on numbers like GDP and employment, it is an unbalanced recovery, and there is a concern that it could be fragile and could have implications for the longer-term financial stability and growth of the U.S. economy. These are very valid concerns. But at a desperate time, the U.S. acted very forcefully, and now it's a time to get the mix of policies straightened out.
Martin Wolf, we had several of our callers referencing inequality one way and another there. You wrote about it at the end of September, said it's a moral and political question, but also an economic one. And beyond a certain point, inequality itself a source of, as you say, significant economic ills. U.S. 2013, the top 3% of income distribution of earners got 30% of total income. Do we have a problem now with inequality that's pressing in the United States? Globally, is the potential source of significant economic ills kicking in, Martin, or is that something in the future?
This is a very difficult and of course, inevitably controversial mm-hmm. issue in terms of the economic effects. I am now persuaded that it is creating significant economic effects, which have been ongoing now for quite a while, and particularly in two areas. I think it creates problems in terms of balanced growth in demand, because essentially we're dependent so much on the consumption of relatively rich people because they have such a high proportion of national income. Mm-hmm. And on the whole, relatively rich people don't consume so much. Mm-hmm. So that's one issue. And the other issue, which I highlighted, is a very long-term issue, but I think there's a very clear evidence that as people become relatively poor, this also affects family formation, stable households, the sort of jobs that people have, and this then affects the ability and success in rearing well-educated, productive adults of the future. So it creates a sort of vicious circle. And if, as well as pointing out, there's also massive cuts in public education spending, which are likely to affect these people in relatively disadvantaged people most severely, then you could get a really quite bad spiral. And there is some evidence that it's not decisive, but I think it's pretty clear that American relative educational performance has been deteriorating. There's no doubt, in addition to this, and that point was made by one of your callers, that GDP isn't a very good measure because, as it were, the average is diverging so much from the median. In other words, because we are so much of the income growth, and it's been huge since the crisis, is going to a relatively small proportion of the population, and not just in America, it's also happening here in the UK, then when you measure GDP, you're measuring very much what's happening to this relatively small proportion of people. And most people, the majority of workers, are not experiencing any increases in living standards. That was already true before the crisis, and it's been exacerbated since. Well, if the economy doesn't generate rising living standards for most people in a democracy, sooner or later, most people are going to get very irritated or angry or furious. And by the way, exactly the same thing is now happening in Europe, made worse by the fact that even the averages aren't rising.
There's another kind of perhaps geopolitical concern, domestic. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the global economy. What's going on? Markets wobbly. Big questions on many fronts. U.S. seen as an anchor right now, but does that last? Iswar Prasad is with us, author of The Dollar Trap, How the U.S. Dollar Tightened Its Grip on Global Finance. Martin Wolf is with us from London, chief economics commentator at the Financial Times, author of the new book, The Shifts and the Shocks, What We've Learned and Have Still to Learn from the Financial Crisis. You've got a lot of people in the world to work and buy. Why not a good global economy? What will it take? Lots of feedback on the web and Twitter and Facebook. Here's Jim on the website, onpointradio.org. He says, a few concerns. He's got eight here. Ebola, Putin, China slow growth, China real estate, Hong Kong protest, Europe, ISIS, end of QE, quantitative easing. We've got callers on some of those. I'll take them to Martin and Iswar. Paul in Fairfield, Iowa. Paul, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you, Tom. I was just curious what comments your guests might make about the impact of Ebola on the West Africa countries and how that might affect ultimately the other countries in Africa, European economies, and then, you know, eventually the world economies, if at all.
Absolutely. Paul, we'll jump right on it, and I appreciate your call. Iswar, Ebola, it's clearly hitting West Africa very hard right now. What about its potential for economic disruption there and beyond?
At this moment, it's largely a matter of fear, Tom, because the economic impact of Ebola has been relatively limited to that part of the world. Now, those are countries that are, of course, in rather fragile shape, both in terms of their economies and in terms of their governance. So there is a concern that those economies might be very hard hit. But the reality is that we live now in a world that is very, very tightly connected through people traveling, through goods being exported and imported, through financial flows. And there is a sense that all of these channels provide ways for even for something like Ebola to very quickly start affecting the rest of the world. And I think that feeds into this fear. And as you pointed out, there are a number of reasons why people are very worried right now. So Ebola just adds to that fear. I think so far the economic impact has been limited, but the concern that it could set back what is already a very fragile recovery in many parts of the world, I think is the bigger concern at this stage, especially if it ends up affecting world trade in some way.
I mean, we don't all have to get sick. We just have to stop traveling or goods stop moving, and you've got big problems. We'll look at more on the geopolitical front. We have to turn to China, such a big factor here. Here's a spokesman for the National Bureau of Statistics of China. This is Xing Laiyun, commenting this week on China's third quarter 7.3% growth. That is the slowest in 5 years, translated here by CCTV.
Looking at the data, sure, there's been a slowdown, but the country's economic operations are still within the normal range. Given the complex international economic situation, growth in the third quarter faced a lot of pressure. To keep stable economic growth was not an easy task.
Martin Wolf, what is China up against right now?
Again, I'd just like to comment. I feel very strongly that the reaction to Ebola is it's a very important disease in West Africa, mm-hmm. but it's real hysteria, mm-hmm. real hysteria. Mm-hmm. There's no basis for this panic. And I assume in the next few months we will realize that we will manage it effectively and it's not going to be a huge problem.
I think as soon as it is managed effectively, that will go away. But people want to see that management.
I think we're already beginning to see mm-hmm. the process. We just get there too slowly. On China, I think it's a utterly fascinating situation. China is slowing down naturally and normally. Let's be very, very clear about that. It's made unbelievable progress in the last 3.5 decades, and growth rates of 10% were going to become increasingly difficult. Mm. The question that really arises is how well can they manage this slowdown? And the concern I have, and I suspect many other people have, is, and I've had this now for 10 years, is that unfortunately, or perhaps inevitably, this happens, China's economy became very unbalanced in the last 10 to 15 years. And particularly...
On what axis, Martin?
Sorry?
On what axis?
That's what I'm going to explain.
Oh, sorry,
in particular, it became incredibly dependent on investment, which is about 50% of GDP, particularly after the crisis. It rose from little over 40 to 50% to offset the decline in export earnings. So it's unbelievably dependent on investment. And in the last 4 or 5 years, that investment was associated with a giant credit boom, one of the biggest in history. And credit outstanding relative to GDP is about 240%, which is incredibly high for a medium-income economy mm-hmm. like China. Mm-hmm. And the question is this. The investment growth must slow. You can't have an economy which is growing 7% or so, invest 50% of GDP. It doesn't make any sense. And the credit growth must slow. Now, the question that the Chinese face is, can we slow the investment growth very sharply, which we clearly will need to do, and slow the credit growth and still maintain overall growth at the rate we want in a country where consumption is private consumption is much less than 50% of GDP? My guess, that's much more significant than a huge financial crisis. I don't expect the financial sector to collapse. That can be managed by the Chinese government in many, many ways. We're not going to have, I think, a replica of what happened to the West. But the question is, how does the future growth work when the starting point is so radically unbalanced?
Ishwar, what do you see in China? And maybe we should look at India as well. They've got new leadership there, which seems pretty pro-business, if that's what you're looking for. What about these two big up-and-comings?
So let's start with China. China, as always, remains a bundle of paradoxes. As Martin has pointed out, some of these numbers, like the level of bank credit compared to GDP and the rate at which it's still growing, that economy should have had a crisis by now, but they've managed to blunder along. Now, the difficulty is really in the medium term, by which I mean beyond the next couple of years. They have enough room in terms of monetary policy, in terms of fiscal policy, to keep growth going at the rate of 7 to 7.5% over the next couple of years. But how they do it becomes very important, and whether they can manage to put in place the sort of reforms they're talking about, especially financial market reforms, which will generate more benefits for households who are leaving their money in banks, and also allocate capital more effectively. Mm. See, China is investing a lot, but it's still a developing economy that could use more investment, but better investment, I think, is the key issue right
now. And they're buying all over the world. They're buying, the big hotel in New York and all the places. Ishwar, let me ask you, if China stumbles, if something should happen there and they really stumble, how does that affect the rest of the world?
The important issue here is that China has become the main driver of global growth. If you measure it at market exchange rates, it's a little more than half the size of the U.S. economy, mm-hmm. but it's growing so much faster that it's become the main contributor to world growth. It's sucking up commodities from a lot of countries, both developed and emerging. So if China slows down, it will affect all of world growth. It'll hurt the commodity producers, and it'll have a pretty significant ripple effect. Like Martin, I don't see a financial crisis as being the main risk, but how they manage this growth process is going to create some risks for the medium term in terms of the growth process. Now, India, on the other hand, is an interesting bright spot in addition to the U.S., but it's coming off a much lower level. The last couple of years have not been good for India, but there is a new government in place, and it got off to a somewhat slow start with the new Prime Minister. Mr. Modi did come in with a very decisive mandate, so there was a desire or a hope that he would put in place lots of very quick reforms. We didn't see that in the first 100, 120 days, but just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of important steps to reduce fuel subsidies, which have not been delivering benefits to the poor and distort product markets and prices a lot. There are measures to improve the functioning of the labor market, to put money in infrastructure, and at the same time try to manage inflation and the fiscal deficit. So among the emerging markets, I think India really stands out as the one country with positive growth momentum.
Joan in Madison, Wisconsin. Joan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Gentlemen, I'd like you to comment on my theory. My feeling is because of the falling and declining birth rates in the industrialized countries, their economies have continued to slow down, and now we can see that in China. And as the gentleman just said, India is the one bright spot because when the population is growing, there's a greater demand for consumer goods, more households are being formed.
Hey, Joan, to your theory, what about no more population growth but better income distribution so that the people who are here can afford a little more? What about that, Joan?
Oh, that would be wonderful, sir. but I just think that with declining birth rates.
Yeah, you wonder about the market.
You're going to see this in China, too. You're going to see China continue to decline.
It's an interesting point. No, Joan, let us take it. Our time begins to grow short. Martin, if I may, hold Joan's thought from Madison and put it together here with another listener writing online, complaining about all the focus on growth itself, saying, I mean, Joan's saying, let's get some more people out there buying and economic activity. Here, NJ says that whole growth economy is old, outmoded, short-sighted, a system which increasingly relies on inputs of finite resources, relies on the finite ability of the planet's ecological systems to absorb and tolerate the abuse of from growth. Is there an issue here with resource limits, not just of commodities, but of the very atmosphere that surrounds us and all the rest, Martin? Does that impinge on the global economy at some point? Does it now?
Well, I think it's not in terms of the actual facts, as opposed to what we think should be happening morally, it's not, I think, a decisive constraint. There is evidence real commodity prices have been relatively high. I think that's driven by increasing demand for commodities from particularly China, as was mentioned. And that's a factor in our economy. It's redistributed the proceeds of growth, but it hasn't stopped growth. The world economy, let's continue to emphasize that, is continuing to grow very rapidly, at well over 3% a year overall. This is really pretty good. There are two other questions about this. In the long run, are resources likely to stop us from growing? In the long run, it's possible, but we are talking, I think, quite far in the future. In the long run, however, there are, and this is the second question, which to me is much more important, there are some byproducts of growth and which create potentially very serious environmental problems, which might not stop growth at all, but are still very, very important. To me, the most important such problems are global warming and the effect we're having on the oceans. And I do believe, on the evidence I have seen, and I've written quite a lot about it, is that we can combine smart growth, if you like, with managing these global commons problems, but we need to. So I don't think we can stop or morally entitled to stop growth, at least in the emerging world. Most of the people of the world remain very, very poor. We cannot possibly tell them to stop growing while we continue to consume such massive amounts of resources in the developed world. So that's morally impossible. But we do have to work out a way of combining growth smartly with managing our global limits. And the ones I am most concerned about, as I said, are the climate system and the oceans.
Love to get smarter right there. Atlanta, Georgia. John, you're on the air. Thank you for calling, John.
Hi, Tom. Gentlemen. I have a question. This is a fascinating discussion, especially with the global economy. And clearly, we've gotten more interdependent over the decades. But as they say about politics, economics is local as well. And I think, and I'd love to get the opinions here, I think that we're still suffering from the overhang of not taking the medicine we might have needed to in 2009, such that I'm a small business owner. I employ 6 to 12 people.
Yep.
And I have a very difficult time, almost impossible, raising people's wages because of all the cuts I sell to corporate entities, and they are cutting their purchases or cutting my prices on me. And how do we gain that growth when I can't afford to pay anybody more and I've been cutting my own income, and I know other small businesses are suffering from this same phenomenon.
Sort of wage stagnation. That's a big issue. We'll look at it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. John, in Atlanta, you said we didn't take the medicine. What medicine are you talking about?
I would, again, my opinion that during the financial crisis, we should have allowed banks to endure a little more pain, let the private sector bail them out rather than the government. In my opinion, lending would have been easier or more appropriate now versus the banks still sort of protecting their balance sheets.
Yeah, we got it, John. Martin Wolf, wage stagnation. Here's a small businessman, 6 to 12 employees. He would like to get out of it, and he can't. Maybe his own wages even, in a sense, stagnating. How do we break that?
Well, I think that I understand very much what your caller is talking about, but I think he's got it the wrong way around.
Okay.
I think if we'd allowed it, and I think this is essentially what many people feel, you know, the banks to get in even more difficulty, not rescue them, and not pursue these ultra-aggressive monetary policy, we would have simply had a depression. And in a depression, nobody would have been paying the small business people, and far more of them would have gone bust than actually did, and it would look like the 1930s, which really is not something we wanted to experience.
Nope.
So I was very strongly supportive of policies to prevent that, this cascade of bankruptcies that could have happened. But as you said, I've described this as a managed depression. Why is it a managed depression? We went into the crisis, in my view, with fundamentally weak sources of global demand. There are whole reasons for that. And now, however, we're in what's sometimes called a balance sheet recession. That is to say, there's too much debt in the private sectors of many countries in the developed world, and the governments are not being allowed to run offsetting fiscal deficits, so they're increasingly constrained. That's very much true in the US. So the only thing that is pushing the economy forward, unfortunately, in this balance sheet recession with this debt overhang, which has got better but it's still not eliminated, is this ultra-aggressive monetary policy, which everybody complains about, but it's what we've got. Unfortunately, it's not as effective as we like. And the result is, therefore, there's not the buoyant demand we want. We can't pay higher wages. There's lots of excess capacity in the world. There's immense excess capacity in the world.
What do you want then? And more deficit spending, Martin? Forgive me, our time is so short, but is that what you're saying?
You have to start thinking about what are going to be the sources of demand in the world. So if you're talking about Chinese consumption, that's a big deal. It would mean more deficit spending, without a doubt. I think we tightened our fiscal deficits much too quickly in the developed world. And it would mean serious income redistribution, which we haven't even thought about. So the problem, in my view, is that this is a very rare situation, but I think we're actually in a globally structural underconsumption situation. Very rare event, hasn't happened since the 30s, and that's a managed depression. And we are managing it, but unfortunately, it still globally feels like a depression.
A managed depression. You have given us so much to think about. I think my bottom line is nobody can just coast here. No one can glide. We've got work to do on policy fronts. You helped us see that wonderfully clearly this hour. Martin Wolf at the Financial Times, author of The Shifts and the Shocks. Thank you for joining us from London. And Ishwar Prasad in Washington, author of The Dollar Trap. Ishwar, thank you very much for being with us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.